The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Good morning. Angelica, so how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm great, actually. How are you?
Good. How's the weather over there in Sweden?
It's cold and rainy and dark and not pleasant at all.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so how's the weather over at yours?
It's actually rather nice out. Cold, but, you know, we should be expecting that for this time of year, so I'm happy.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess if you're ready to get rolling, we can get started.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema and music. Tonight, the lovely and talented Angelica Rillon of Murder of My Sweet and the legendary Michael Kiska of Halloween on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Third Eye Cinema, your source for music and film that matter. Cult, underground, independent, and generally falling outside the mainstream corporate boardroom paint-by-numbers bullshit. Tonight, we brush up our vocal chops and run a few scales with a pair of notable European metal vocalists. First up, we have with us a young woman who's made something of a name for herself among modern metal circles. With her powerful vocal presence and notably fetching looks, she's been a major factor in putting Swedish gothic metal band The Murder of My Sweet on the map. With a new solo record that taps more into traditional 80s metal AOR vibe, she has most assuredly taken center stage, delivering even more pronounced focus on those soaring vocals. Join us as we speak to the lovely and talented Angelica Rillon, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, here's the lady herself, and she's coming to your rescue.
For my only way to be.
Tonight, we're talking music, and we have with us a young woman who's made something of a name for herself among modern metal circles. With her powerful vocal presence and notably fetching looks, she's been a major factor in putting Swedish gothic metal band The Murder of My Swede on the map. With a new solo record that taps more into the traditional 80s metal AOR vibe, she has most assuredly taken center stage through delivering even more pronounced focus on those soaring vocals. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the lovely and talented Angelica Ryland. Angelica, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So let's backtrack a little bit for those unfamiliar with who you are and where you're coming from. The Murder of My Swede, your main band, is an interesting project in and of itself. You know, it's sort of a cross between Lacuna Coil, early Evanescence, and a touch of Edenbridge in the smooth male backing vocal choruses and the string and oboe sections that pop in and out. It's also pretty modern and radio-friendly in orientation, but it can loosely be identified as gothic metal. You know, I'd sort of compare you a bit to Nemesi or post-Tarja Nightwish in this respect, though the vocals are more along the lines of, say, Christina Scabbia than any of the others I've mentioned. One thing that's interesting about your music, with both Murder My Swede and now solo, is that you're quite grounded in contemporary lyric. You know, there's no songs about, like, nymphs and sirens or struggles with the power of darkness or what have you.
So, yeah.
It's very much about relationships, introspection, and metacognition, and it's ultimately a very personal lyrical style. So were the lyrics primarily your doing? Because it's very yin and quite feminine in that respect.
Yeah, they are actually. Both with The Murder of My Swede and for this my solo project, I've written the lyrics myself, or at least for most of the songs on the Thrive album. So, you know, I always try to go from the core of what I believe and what I feel and what I think about, and then I try to, you know, collect influences and inspiration from things around me, that's surrounding me, movies that I've seen or books that I read. But, you know, I always try to start from a core that's within myself, so to speak.
Another thing that I find a bit odd is that Murder of My Swede is generally considered to be a metal act, but your solo material comes out on Frontiers as being marketed more as AOR. But I don't hear major differences musically. I mean, the solo stuff is less electronically touched up, the guitars aren't quite as down-tuned, but neither act really sounds all that grinding and pounding to my ears in the first place. You know, everything you do is quite melodic.
Right from the beginning, I tried to make these two projects as different from each other as possible, and I actually believe that they are quite different, but, you know, it's still me that's singing, and I sound like I sound, you know, I have my own sound in a way, and but I really wanted to keep the spirit and the energy from, you know, like the old 80s AOR type of rock, but also I wanted to take it up a notch and make it a little bit more modern in types of production and chords and also maybe the lyrics, I don't know. So I think it can be quite hard to make them, like, you know, totally super different from one another. So, of course, it's some of the same team. It's me and it's Daniel that's doing both The Murder of My Swede and the solo project. So, of course, there will be similarities, but I tried it, you know, to make them quite different from each other anyway, because otherwise what would be the point? It would only be another The Murder of My Swede album, just under a different label and under a different name. So
tell us a bit about Thrive. You know, what made you want to break off from the guys, however temporarily, to put this solo project together?
Yeah, well, actually, it was Frontiers Records that contacted me about, I think it was 2 years ago or something like that. And they approached me and asked me if I wanted to do an AOR project and, you know, try to do a solo project from it. And I instantly, I never hesitated for a second, because this was the kind of music that I grew up to with my parents and my older sister listening to. So it felt quite natural to pursue this type of music. It's always been there in the background. And as I said before, I love the spirit in it and the energy. And, you know, it's still a special way when you're listening to it. It's full of energy, and it's even the sad songs, you know, have a positive vibe in them. So that was something I was looking forward to very much to try and pursue.
So getting back to what we were talking about earlier, where do you hear the major differences between what you're doing with Murder My Swede and the Angelica solo project? Because for my part, I'm hearing more major keys here. You get the well-constructed bridges and transitional parts to the songs, and a dash more of a traditional 80s metal, if not pop, feel to it. but it's still very much modern metal, or at least hard melodic rock. You know, the production style is still pretty in your face. The instruments are kind of shoved up right up front with you. The guitars are still chunky and a bit downtuned, but, you know, it's more, they seem to me a little bit more similar than different. So where do you see the differences here?
Well, I guess with the Murder of My Sweet, we try and pursue more of, we find our inspiration and influences from movies, you know. So we try to have the production and the orchestration sound more like you could find like the score to a movie. And for this Thrive project, I wanted it to be more, you know, straight up melodic song inspired more from the 80s than, what you hear in movies today. But of course, as I've seen, there's a lot of, you know, the kids today, they're starting to find all these great 80s bands. So I can see what you mean. It's hard to find the difference between the two, but I really think that we have aimed for two separate directions.
And you're certainly not tapping into, like, old film noir here.
No, definitely not.
There's also a pronounced melancholy to the music that underpins and comments on all the soaring vocals. I have to assume this is deliberate. So what were you trying to say with that?
When I wrote the lyrics for Thrive, I wanted it to, because, you know, all these 80s music, the instant they get you thinking about love, and I find it hard to write a whole full album without, you know, touching the topic. So I wanted it to be, you know, a straight up melodic love album, and I've sort of dug into the feelings and things that I've experienced, and or just as simple as what my vision or my image of love, about what it is, you know, it can be totally wonderful, you know, pink clouds and everything, and it can be heartbreaking and terrible and hard, and, you know, so I wanted to sort of get you the picture of my idea of love.
Right, which actually to me seems a little disturbing, because most of the songs, when I'm hearing the lyrics, seem to be about breakups or uncertain relationships. So if that's your idea of love, I'm a little scared.
No, I have hopes for love too, you know. But you know, we've all been there, you know, with breakups and making tough decisions. But I also feel that this album is about empowerment and, you know, believing in yourself but never giving up and knowing when it's time to move on and actually doing it, because, you know, you can't just stay in a relationship if you don't see it going anywhere. So, you know, taking the decisions even though it's hard. So
yeah, definitely. I've got years of experience that confirms that one, so I'm with you. But, you know, I'm not waiting in particular. You know, I love that opening line. I'm nothing like those girls before because I've got brains. Because, you know,
yeah.
From personal experience, there's a lot of dim bulbs running around out there. So it's nice to find someone with a bit of substance for a change.
Yeah.
I also like how the backing vocals are more of you tracking yourself. The sound is far more light and female than you get with Murder My Sweet. You know, it's not like what you're doing there is with those smooth Eden Bridge style backing vocals aren't really nice, but this lends like a different tonality to the proceedings. So was that, again, was this deliberate?
Yeah, I think it was actually. But I also had help with a guy called Anders Vigelius that did the backing vocals. And, you know, they did a Vigilius album, I think it was maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, with Frontiers Records, and he's the guy that lives in Sweden and sometimes in Stockholm, my town. So I hooked up with him, and he did some amazing backing vocals. He's very, very talented, great singer. So he had almost free hands. He could almost do whatever he wanted, and almost everything that he sent us was great right from the beginning. So
now, it's quite evident that you're a very attractive young lady with good fashion sense to boot. And while there's certainly more than a fair share of gothic symphonic acts fronted by good-looking women, do you find that to be something of a block to being taken seriously by the musician community at large?
You know, that topic has actually been up to debate a lot around the internet. And I believe it is true that most women get judged, firstly and primarily, by their looks, and secondly, or almost last, about their performance. And of course, I think that's sad, but, you know, I like to look at beautiful things, and I believe that other people like to look at beautiful things too. So I do believe that it has a great point of, I think it's very important to, you know, take care of yourself and look good and have, you know, nice pictures and stuff like that. But you know, if you can't back the good looks up, then, you know, what's the point?
Right. And, you know, what I was thinking is that while some of these ladies are obviously very talented, you get Liv Christine and Jian Cho and Tarsha Turunen, Melissa Furlock just being the tip of the iceberg here, I don't think many folks out there are sitting back saying, damn, that Christina Scavi is a great singer. It's more like, good God, she's hot. You know, it still sells tickets, but it leads to a little less credibility in the long run. So, you know, this is kind of a pertinent question.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you never see polls like the 100 top talented singers in the world. You always see the top 10 most sexiest women in metal, you know.
Right.
So, it's quite tiring in the end, actually. But
that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, how do you feel this impacts your career? And you find that people still are focusing on that over your talent and over your songwriting abilities and whatever. You know, is this sort of a block to you, do you feel? Or is it just, well, look, you know, people are listening, so we'll go from there and see what happens?
Yeah, no, I don't find it as a block or something like that. No, I don't. I do think it can be a bit tiring from time to time, but, you know, that's the way that it is today, and I don't believe I can do much about it. But I'm just trying to focus on being myself and doing what I love. And, of course, I want people to listen to the album, and I want them to love it. So I'm just trying to do the best that I can, and, you know, I can't do anything else than that.
And I've got to say that I was quite pleasantly surprised by Thrive. You know, it was both exactly what I expected and quite a different beast entirely. Because, you know, it's very catchy and it shows off your vocal abilities a bit more than comes across in Murder My Sweet. I mean, you know, the ending of Coming to Your Rescue alone, the breath control, the vibrato, the sustain, that's well beyond what I've come to expect from your average alto.
Yeah, thank you.
So do you have any tour plans? Will you be hitting the States in the coming year, either solo or with Murder My Sweet?
That is a dream of mine. I would very much want to go to, you know, like a worldwide tour. I mean, who doesn't want to do that? But I have nothing confirmed at the moment, but I'm guessing we'll have to just wait and see how the album will be received by the audience. And, you know, if the fans are happy to support me, then hopefully that will lead to me going to a tour someday. I very, very much want to do that. So,
anything you'd like?
My fingers up.
So anything you'd like to plug, or did you want to point listeners to your website or your Facebook page?
Yeah, of course. You can find me on Facebook, /Angelica.Rillin. And I would very much encourage you to buy the album because, you know, it's not only great songs, but it's also the music video included. So another reason for buying the album.
Well, with that, Angelica, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema. And we'd love to have you back to talk your next album or project.
Yeah, I'd love to. Anytime.
All right, so it was a pleasure, and, you know, seriously, next time you have something out, I'd be happy to have you on again.
Yeah, I'll be happy to, anytime.
All right, well, thank you, have a good day, and hope to see you soon.
Yeah, you too. Have a great one.
You too, bye.
Bye.
And to close out our interview with Angelica, without any further ado, here's another one off Thrive, because she's not waiting.
Nothing like those guys before. 'Cause I've got brains and no open book. You have to read your hooks until the ending. Ironic how I stand here now, sentimentally abused. But I'm not waiting. Won't be a fool no more. I close the door. Not waiting for you to come. I'm not waiting. 40 days, 40 nights, I've been waiting for this day, and here it comes.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Stay tuned for Michael Kiska. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema.
Thomas Olson from the band Bloodbound, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, here's Matt Sinner of Primal Fear and Sinner, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Okay, hi there, this is George and Thomas from Serenity, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema show together with Team.
That's right.
Should we do it one more time? Yes, okay. So, hi there, this is Georg and Thomas from Serenity, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, everybody. Shall I start again? Okay. Hi, everybody. Alex from Atrocity. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy the day.
Hi, this is Udo Dobson, the singer of UDO. And you listen to the show Third Eye Cinema.
Okay, let me know when you're ready. Hey, Metalheads, Leather Leone here from Chastain, and as you know, we're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy.
Oh, wait, here it comes. Okay, finally. So, hello, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning. It's morning on your end. Here's evening.
So, how's the weather over there in Germany?
Actually, it was quite nice. It was peeing the last couple of days, but today was quite sunny. Still cold, but sunny.
Good to hear that. Well, not good to hear about the rain, just good to hear it was sunny.
Half of it. Half of it was good to hear.
So, we can get rolling whenever you're ready.
I'm ready.
Next up, a true legend among traditional thrash, speed, and power metal fans in particular, not to mention a true inspiration among metal vocalists per se. Making his mark as the second and easily best of the frontmen for the great Teutonic speed thrash power metal act Helloween, it was his golden voice that brought the legendary Keeper of the Seven Keys albums to international acclaim and prominence. After two more albums that found the band expanding their direction and exploring a bit musically, he moved on to a string of solo albums and guest appearances on literally dozens of albums across the European metal spectrum. Currently fronting a hard-edged melodic AOR metal project named Place Vendôme, join us as we speak to legendary vocalist Michael Kiska, only here on Third Eye Cinema. And it sounds like Michael's really eager for this interview because here he is asking me to talk to him. We have with us tonight a legend among traditional thrash, speed, and power metal fans in particular, not to mention a true inspiration among metal vocalists per se. Making his mark as the second and easily best of the frontmen for the great Titanic speed thrash power metal act Helloween, it was his golden voice that brought the legendary Keeper of the Seven Keys albums to international acclaim and prominence. After two more albums that found the band expanding their direction and exploring a bit musically, he moved on to a string of solo albums and guest appearances on literally dozens of albums across the European metal spectrum. Currently fronting a hard-edge, melodic AOR metal project named Place Vendôme, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming none other than Michael Kiska. Michael, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Sorry, I was interrupting you. Good evening. Good morning on your end.
Let me start this one off by complimenting you on maintaining that voice for all these years. Because what's fascinating to me about this is that most guys who had that sort of soaring, high-end, almost Irish tenor tonality back in the 80s have unfortunately completely lost it in their voices in the process, the legendary Jeff Tate being the most precipitous fall among many. And yet, here you are sounding more or less the same as ever, hitting all those high notes with force, certainty, and sustain. I mean, it's really quite impressive in that respect.
Well, I mean, I was just practicing March of Time today, because I'm going to do that in December with an orchestra over here. We do like a tour with an orchestra, and I can still do it, and I can still switch to that old mode, you know, of singing if I want to. I'm not sure about if Geoff Tate is not able to do it anymore. I think it is, in his case, I don't know, I'm not 100% sure, but to me his voice still sounds fine when you hear him talk or sing. I have the impression that he either doesn't want to, or it's more like a psychological thing or something like that. I don't really know, but it's hard for me to believe that he's not capable of doing it anymore.
Yeah, see, I'm going by a concert that I saw him in about a year ago, and it was just like he just couldn't do it. And I was like, wow, what happened? Whereas yes. I'm listening to you, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, this guy can still do it. So.
Yeah, I honestly think when it comes to singing, as long as you work with your voice, you know, as long as you try to deal with the changes that happen when you get older, what happens to the vocal cords is that they usually get a little thicker, you know.
Right.
So it's like, but that's most of the time actually something good, because you get more volume, you get more resonance, you get more sound. I don't sound as thin as I sounded when I was a teenager, you know.
Right.
I have more. The voice just sounds thicker, and I think it sounds better. And everything else is just a question of working with your voice. And maybe that's what many don't do. I don't know. Or maybe they do something wrong so that they burn their voice. I'm not smoking. I'm sure that helps too. You know.
I'm sure that definitely helps. But you're right. I mean, as you get older, your voice does deepen and gives you a lot more resonance. So it should be a positive, but, you know, apparently
absolutely
not always.
I honestly think that it has a lot to do with the head.
True.
It's like, because, I mean, just put yourself in the shoes of a singer that were able to sing in a certain way, and then the voice changes. You know, like I said, it gets the vocal cords get thicker, and the voice gets a little lower. And you can't do it exactly the same way maybe anymore like you used to do it. And then they start worrying, what's happening? I can't do this anymore. And then they start pushing maybe.
Right.
Maybe then they violate the voice or whatever. And that maybe they just have a wrong approach to it. You know, it's just my suggestion or my guess that I have.
Because exactly.
I honestly don't think it is necessary to not be able to do anything that you've done in the past anymore. Just
right.
Because you're getting older, you know.
Exactly. I mean, that's just what I'm saying. It's like, I was impressed that you were still able to do this stuff. Because, you know, like we're talking about, the vocal cords get longer, you get older. You know, sometimes people just get rusty. Who knows what happens? Years of being on the road. But all this is not even to mention the fact that you're still a proper singer in the true sense, with vibrato and the know-how to finesse a true note, which is different from the kind of current pop diva school, you know, this kind of air raid siren scream from the back of your throat and just hold a tone without stylizing a thing that came up with, you know, Houston, yeah. Mariah Carey, that kind of thing. And that stuff is actually kind of painful to my ears. I'm amazed everyone latched on to it. It's like fake emotion. It's nice to hear people that are actually still almost like a Sinatra kind of a thing, where you know how to take a note and just stylize it. You know, you play with it. You don't just hit a tone and hold it like an electronic tone or something.
I'm actually dealing a lot with my voice. I mean, it's like I sing not only if I have to, I also sing because I enjoy it. It's like I'm an Elvis fan, and I love singing, especially the silent Elvis tunes that he has recorded, like in the 60s, some of this stuff. Because
right.
First of all, I think it's great for warming up the vocal cords.
Right.
The way he sang there, for some reason, it's just perfect for my voice. If I do that for like half an hour, or if I'm like really worn out on a tour, I do it maybe very easily for an hour. It's just medicine for my voice. But it's also medicine for my soul. I just, like Elvis sang gospels,
yes,
you know, as some kind of a spiritual relief. I sing Elvis, you know, and it gives me that kind of great feel. And It has a lot to do with vibrato, and so I mean Elvis had a beautiful singing technique. He could be very wild. He could do jailhouse rock or like Hound Dog or Heartbreak Hotel, and it's very rough, very very aggressively sung. But he could also sing like very very easy tunes and silent tunes in a very charming and convincing way. And I enjoy that type of cultivated singing, you know. So it's certainly always there when I do that type of music like Placid Home.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to convince me. I'm a huge Elvis fan. I always was. And people don't even realize, because he's become sort of this cultural icon, and in some cases people just look at it as a joke, but the guy had a tremendous range, not
absolutely
just musically
said,
and vocally.
The same thing that you just said, I said, like, I think 2 days ago in an interview, that Elvis's talent drowned under the image.
Yes, exactly.
He was so beautiful. He was so great looking and so cool on stage, and he became this American or worldwide icon, larger than life and all that stuff. And people just forgot about his what a great vocalist he was.
Exactly.
He sang so freaking good, and I don't get tired of it. I've got all the CDs. I buy all the special editions with outtakes and stuff like that from that label called Follow That Dream.
Right.
You know, they do those extra releases, like some of the stuff is even, the remixes of the outtakes sound even better than the records sometimes. I mean,
True.
They do it with so much love. And you just hear the guy was such a great vocalist and such a great producer. And it's so sad that all that kind of ended up in the background just because of this image, you know?
It's true. That's kind of what I was speaking to a female vocalist just about an hour ago, and we were talking about how, you know, just because a girl is a good-looking singer, that tends to drown out, you know, whether they're talented or not. You know, people just look at that and say, okay, here's a hot girl, and that's it. That's all they leave it at. And they don't pay attention to, is this person a good songwriter? Is this person, how they stylize notes? You know, how wide is their range? Whenever these things become secondary. And unfortunately, that's kind of what happened with Elvis, even though he was such a talent.
And I think that's part of why he ended that way. The way he ended, because it became such a superficial thing. You know, he was becoming almost like a puppet of his image. You know,
exactly.
And after a while, he was giving into it.
Yeah.
You know, he just gave the people what they wanted. He was, the concerts got boring because he was just, you know, rushing down the hit singles everybody wanted to hear. He couldn't start a real movie career. Even though he had this offer. In 1975, he had this offer from Barbara Streisand, you know, A Star Is Born. Elvis was supposed to do that, and he was really excited about it, and the Colonel talked him out of it. And who knows where he would have been. Maybe he would even be alive today if something with substance would have come his way, like an acting career, or he would have been managed better as an artist. I mean, Elvis was wasted for so many years doing these shitty movies and stuff like that. And thank God he had his comeback for a number of years, you know, 68 to 71, maybe 73. He was still, I mean, especially like 69, 97, he was really on fire again. Not many people actually recognized that. It was not only the young Elvis. Like Paul McCartney doesn't get tired talking about pre-Army Elvis because
right.
That's what he grew up with. But Elvis had it back. He
sure.
was totally on fire again, 68, 69, 97. He really loved it again. And I like that Elvis way better than the teenage idol, you know.
That's right.
But it's like he just lost it because he was managed in the wrong way. You know, the manager didn't take care enough about this artistic kind of way, that he would do something that he would really enjoy and stuff. So he got lost in that, all that image and the quick money and stuff like that. And that, in the end, it broke his soul, you know.
And unfortunately, that actually happens with a lot of musicians and artists across the board these days, in film and books, whatever, because things are being run by, you know, big money, fat cat corporations, and, you know, just hitting the beat points, give me what we want, and people aren't being allowed to express themselves or follow their creative vision all the way. I mean, they give a little bit of it, but it's not enough, and eventually it all just dies out.
Yeah, and then he started to take these drugs more and more. I mean, he was into that, these, I don't know what you call them in English, the stuff that makes you more awake.
Yes, the opposite.
Yeah, he got into that during the Army, and he was really excited about it, but he didn't overdo it to a certain extent. But when he got bored, you know, when all this touring just became like a mechanism or whatever, it just became like the same thing all over again. He was throwing that stuff in more and more and more, making his body sick, and then he couldn't sleep at night anymore, and he had to take pills to get down. You know, he just ruined his health completely by that shit, you know?
True. So now that we've alienated everybody by talking about Elvis. Pardon us, everybody. Two Elvis fans chatting.
Dude, I love him. I love him.
Me too.
He was just great.
We could actually do a separate interview just about Elvis for like 2 hours. So let's go back to the beginning. So how did you wind up working with Helloween? Because before that, lead guitarist Kai Hansen was handling vocals, and while the music on the EP and Walls of Jericho was pretty damn good, it was a rather different feel than where you'd take it shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I had my own school band, like in the middle of 80s, and I was not touring with it. I mean, I started making my own band just out of pleasure. Music. I didn't plan a career or anything like that. You know, I just wanted to play music. That was it.
Right.
So I had my little band, and we played a few Maiden tunes there, and then we started to write our own stuff. Mainly, I wrote most of the stuff that we did there. And I was quite happy with that, you know. And then one day, Marcus, the bass player, ended up at our rehearsal room. And he said, oh, you know, I'm Marcus. I play with Helloween. We're actually looking for a singer like you, you know, because the singer we have at the moment, he can only sing for two shows, and then his voice is gone.
Right.
He wants to just concentrate on the guitars, and we want to get someone in who can take over the vocals, you know. Would you be interested? And he gave me Walls of Jericho, and I must say that it wasn't really my cup of tea.
Okay.
When I heard that record, I didn't like it very much, so I didn't call him back. Then a few weeks went by, and then I still remember I was in the bathtub. I was still living with my parents, and my mother gave me the phone. There's a guy called Michael Wycath. He wants to talk to you. And then, you know, he said to me, yeah, I know, Walls of Jericho is a bit punky and stuff like that, but we want to go somewhere else. We want to extend. We want to develop. We need a singer like you to do that, you know. And he sounded very interesting. I mean, I was quite excited about what he had planned. And as soon as I got into the rehearsal room with them, and they had already started writing some material for my voice,
right.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think something like Future World was already there, you know, that Kai had written with my voice in his head and stuff. And I loved it right away. I just thought it was great, you know. And it kind of, again, very naturally fell into place. I never plan anything when it comes to this. I lead my whole life like that, to be honest with you. I'm not someone who plans his life. I just take it as it comes, you know?
I'm the same way, so it's actually a good thing sometimes.
I can't do it any other way, you know?
So you're pretty much the new kid with no real experience on this sort of international level, and yet you walk in the door with three songs. And we'll get to the whole double album business in a bit, but let's hone in on that point. How strange is that, and how loose of a band were Helloween in those days to allow that kind of freedom and power to a new recruit?
Well, that was material that I had written for my school band, you know, we were jamming it, and I suggested the songs, you know, they were writing songs, and they liked them, and then in the rehearsal room, of course, they made it their own. I mean, so the song sounded different, of course, I mean, but that's what a band is for, you know, that you give it your own fingerprint, and that's
right.
What they did. I mean, I remember we got the ride, I had more simple guitar, more like a rhythm guitar. I had the same verses. I had the same kind of melody. I mean, that was there, but my guitar arrangement was different. And I remember that Kai went this, you know, he did that on that, which was great. And that was, I think they were quite happy to have more material there, you know, the more the better.
So you guys record 14 songs, two of which were 15-minute long suites, and a few brief instrumental intros to open and close the album. Why did Keeper of the Seven Keys not come out as the intended double album?
Because the record company didn't want to do it. You know, they were just against it. They'd be business decisions. And, of course, we can't decide everything on our own. I mean, we wanted it to be a double album. But honestly, looking back at it, it was good that way, because before we recorded the second half of the songs, we had some touring happening.
Right.
You know, we had some live experiences. We grew as a band. So I think Keeper 2 turned out better than it would have been if we would have recorded the stuff like 2 years earlier or a year earlier, you know.
But the way that it did come out turned out to be a little odd and confusing, because, you know, if there was a story really wending its way through the songs, that kind of got lost in the process.
There was never really a story. I mean, the only thing, that, I mean, the Keeper title came from the song Keeper of the Seven Keys.
Ah.
And it only ended up part one and part two because it was supposed to be a double album. You know, it never had a concept or something. It was just that song, really.
I'm sure you've run across this one before, but back in the day, there was a rumor floating around that Noise decided not only to jumble the order, but cherry-pick all the best tracks for part one and leave the leftovers for part two. But that doesn't really hold up, because you still have, like, Eagle Fly Free, I Want Out, two of the songs you brought. It's a strong album in its own right. So
I like Keeper way more than Keeper 2 way more than Keeper 1, I personally, to be honest with you. No, that's bullshit. I mean, we just selected a couple of songs that we thought would make it nicely on the first one, and then...
Right.
Did the same for the other ones and wrote some more for the second record, you know. There was right. not. There was certainly not leftovers.
Right.
We had like the only real hit single that we had over here in Europe and in Germany, Dr. Steen.
Right.
Was also on that record. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, just for the old guard, I'm sure a lot of people out there remember this rumor floating around. So I wanted to get that addressed. So. After the career highlight of the Keeper album, or albums as it happened, the cracks were already starting to begin the show. So first Kai Hansen leaves to form Gamma Ray, and then Helloween releases no less than three live albums and the greatest hits in the same year in 1989. What the hell was going on?
Did we release three live albums? I thought we only did one, didn't we? Live in UK.
There was a couple of them, actually. But maybe, who knows? Maybe they're...
I think that was afterwards. I think that must have been afterwards. The thing didn't work anymore when Kai left the band. Not because he's the only genius or whatever. I mean,
right.
He was certainly important. But it's more a thing of the chemistry. I'm pretty sure you know what I'm talking about. I mean, you have a bunch of friends, and when you hang with all three together, you have a certain spirit, maybe, and things are fun, and one is not there, it's not the same.
Exactly.
And it's especially like that in the band. There's a certain dynamic, a very sensitive dynamic there. And it's the most stupid thing you can do, trying to change something there, you know, trying to get rid of someone. And unfortunately, Kai was very unhappy with his life in general. I have my own little explanations for that. I mean, I'm always saying I'm pretty sure he regrets it, looking back at it, that he did that. I think it was the biggest mistake that he could have ever done, but I'm sure he wouldn't admit it. The thing is, he had a great position in Helloween. We all loved him. I loved him. You know, he was like the key guitar player. We loved his songs. We loved him. And everything was great. He had a great position in this band. It was absolutely not necessary for him to leave this band. But he was unhappy, and I think he was projecting things into the band that was really just happening in him and himself. That's my explanation.
Because I can hear that, yeah.
I didn't understand why he wanted to leave. But he wanted, and he left. And after that, things very, very quickly changed. It was just not the same anymore. And I'm not saying this because I'm no longer in the band, you know. I really say that because that's the way I see it now, looking back at it. It was just not the same anymore. The whole chemistry was different. And it was not only Kai not there, so his persona, his music, his guitar playing, which is important enough, it was someone else there.
Right.
You know, like Roland, who has his own kind of attitude, his own kind of spirit, and his own kind of songs that he writes. It was not necessarily something wrong with it, but it's different.
Yeah, exactly. You can hear there's a change. So,
yeah, and that we did another thing. We did another thing wrong, which was something Rod Smallwood actually made us do. We changed the producer. You know, we didn't take Tommy Hansen, who was responsible for Keeper 1 and 2, and he was the perfect producer for us as a band. As his person, you know, the personality that he had and the openness. And he was not – I love Tommy Hansen. I don't know how he is these days. I haven't seen him for ages. I only know how he was in those days.
Right.
And I loved him a lot for the – he was not scared, you know. He was – like we were. We didn't care. You know, we just enjoyed the ride. We thought we were the best band in the world anyway.
Right.
We thought we could do anything. You know, you just need that kind of confidence. And luckily we had it. And we just – and Tommy was the right person for it. He was not scared of anything. So we tried that stupid stuff like in the 20s, like the Comedian Harmonies or something like that. I mean, no metal band would have done that, but we did that. And we changed. I mean, I love Rod Smallwood. You know, Rod Smallwood is a great guy. I always loved him. I always had a great relationship with him. Even though I'm not working with him anymore, I still think he's a great guy, you know. But he was wrong. He was talking us into taking Chris Angridis as a producer instead of Tommy Hansen. And that was another thing that was wrong. So it's like, so we did this record, but we basically just re-recorded the pre-production. There was no real record production happening like would have happened with Tommy Hansen in the studio.
Right.
So it's like, so the record was a lot weaker than it could have been. And, you know, and then we did this next one, which was even more extreme in the other direction, and then it was over, you know.
Right. Yeah, I was actually going to get there. There's a 2-year silence, and then in 1991, with metal dying a sudden death over here in the U.S. and Seattle's grunge scene stealing everyone's thunder, Helloween puts out an album that comes right out of left field, which is Pink Bubbles Go 8. First off, what was with the odd song and album titles?
Well, I think it reflects pretty much what was going on. It was some kind of maybe subconscious thing or whatever. I just remember that I was on the phone with Michael Wycath, and I just remember, you know, things that are so crazy, let's do a stupid title. Let's do something like, you know, Pink Bubbles Go Nuts or something like that. and he said, well, let's make Pink Bubbles Go Ape, you know, and then we had it there. It was basically – we were doing what we always did. You know, we were just doing the songs. We had stupid ideas and just did it. You know, it was the same kind of stuff. It was just not working as much anymore. It was just not, you know, we did the best we could out of the situation, you know.
Right.
And I think the title fits. It really does fit.
But, I mean, seriously, you know, Shit and Mobster, the Hamburger Walkways, Heavy Metal Masters. Like, what are these guys smoking?
Yeah, and we had to take some of the stuff on the album that was actually, like, on the Pink Babas album. Some of the songs were actually meant to be on the B-side, you know,
right,
of a single or something, just for a joke. But because of the production was Chris Chagoritas, which I said, it didn't work out. It just didn't happen. We some of the songs just didn't turn out the way we thought they should and whatever, and so we had to take some of the stuff on there, you know, to make it work somehow.
And secondly, you know, as we have mentioned, the sound of the band had changed a bit, and you seem to have taken center stage writing or co-writing all but two tracks on the record. So what happened there?
I didn't take any center stage or something. It was just the same situation. You know, I was writing some songs, the others were writing some songs. I honestly think the biggest changes were Kai not there anymore,
right,
a new guy there, and a different producer. I think the one who took over was Michael Weikath. He was actually taking center stage in my memory.
And then we get a second greatest hits album, and The Deal Breaker, which is, of course, 1993's Chameleon. So what happened? What was with this complete makeover, basically, by the time you got there?
I think by that time, we were told dysfunctional as a band. So what really happened is that actually every songwriter made his solo record,
right,
on the Halloween record. That's what happened. I haven't got any other explanation. We even took Tommy Hansen again. So it was the original producer again. But I just remember that I was even recording guitars for my own song.
Wow.
You know, which was, it's just a sign of things were just not working anymore. We were not functioning as a band anymore.
So it was Halloween's White Album, in effect.
Yeah, sort of.
So after this, all the tensions or whatever that was going on within and between the band, the label, the management, pretty much led to everything falling apart. So tell us a bit about that and maybe a few words about drummer Ingo Schrickenberg, who also left the band at this time and unfortunately died not long afterwards.
Well, it was, I mean, I was completely doing something else in all those years. I mean, after the split, I dealt with other things. I mean, music was not the main concern for me anymore. I was studying books like philosophy and certain German thinkers that I was interested in. I was like reading for hours every day. It was almost like going to school again, but in my home, you know, my own place. I didn't go to the university for it. I just did it by myself.
Right.
And I had record deals going on, so I had to do a record once file, and I did, but I didn't care that much, you know. It was not at all like it used to be. With Ingo, it has a lot to do with his lifestyle. I mean, he was, I remember that after the Keeper 2 album, after Kai left, we had these legal courts, these legal situations going on, Sanctuary, like the management of Iron Maiden and Wasp and some other acts, and also Halloween in those days. They were trying to get us out of the record deals because they cheated on us like hell, you know?
Right.
They stole every penny that we should have made and stuff like that. So they were going on court for us and stuff like that. And because of the situation, we got injuncted.
Right.
We had like over a year, it was almost 2 years where we couldn't do anything. We couldn't go on tour, we couldn't produce a record or whatever. So I just remember that my previous girlfriend, I just have these images in my head that we were out there in the nature, like in the grass, playing badminton and stuff like that.
Right.
That was actually what I did, reading a little bit, watching movies and playing badminton and, you know, these kind of things. That's how this time looks to me. And I just remember that I didn't see Ingo for a while. You know, I didn't see him for a whole year. And he was quite good looking. He was the Bon Jovi type of guy, you know, in his prime. And I just remember when I saw him again after this year, I was shocked the way he looked. You know, he looked like 10 years older. He really looked bad. And then I thought, what's going on? We all did not know by that time what really was going on. You know, when he was, his girlfriend that he was living together with for a number of years left him. And she once told me that she couldn't stand it anymore, finding these cocaine thingies in his pants. right. and stuff like that. She just, and that's when we started to discover that he had a serious drug problem. He was drinking a lot anyway.
Right.
I remember conversations with him when we recorded the drums of the Pink Bubbles Glaive album, and he drank about 10 beers.
Wow.
Before he even started to record. And I said, Ingo, do you notice how many beers you drank already? And he freaked out, like typical alcoholics do, you know.
Yeah.
They don't want to sit. He freaked out. He said, Michael, you're not a rock and roller. I don't care. You know, it's like, if you keep on doing it like that, you're going to be dead in 2 years, you know. And I was right.
Wow.
He was dead. I just remember that we all didn't know how to deal with it. We were kind of helpless. And I remember that when we did the last tour, which was the Chameleon tour, he was doing so bad. He was going crazy. He was talking nonsense. And he stopped. Sometimes right in the middle of a show, he stopped playing the drums. And he just fall down on the drums. He just heard whatever voices and things like that. It was just a situation that was not, you couldn't take this guy on the road anymore. So it's like, we said, you know, you get clean, we give you this year, you know, and you try to get clean. And after that, you know, you can come back and whatever. But he just never got it right. He just lost it completely. He was on a suicide mission somehow. Very sad.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen that a lot in my surrounding, you know, especially young people drinking a lot of alcohol. I was always anti. I always hated that. I mean, my father killed himself with alcohol. My brother has been through it all. You know, it's not only alcohol. He's taking almost every drug you can take. He's fine now. You know, he has gotten out of it. But I'm used to that, and I always hated it. So I never took anything. I never drank. Never smoked. I hate that shit. I think it's not good for you. You know,
right.
it's your own enemy. It's gonna kill you slowly. But I mean, that was a very sad kind of situation. And I also must say that Ingo, he couldn't handle the whole situation, like not being on tour, not being kept busy, you know, sitting at home for like almost 2 years, having nothing to do. He just couldn't handle it. I mean, he probably would have gone the same way just a number of years later, I guess. But the whole legal crap situation didn't help him at all. I mean, that was pretty bad for him.
Well, from here on out, changing the subject back to music, you recorded 4 solo albums and 2 EPs. You joined Gothic Metal Impresario and voice coach Amanda Somerville for Kiska Somerville. And you sat in with a whole hell of a lot of bands in the power metal spectrum, everything from Gamma Ray to Master Plan to Advancia and Edguy. You're a busy man.
That's what you do when you don't have a band. You know, you just see what comes in. And yeah, and I mean, I some of the stuff just lingers on, even though I have Unisonic now, because I can't stop it. You know, it's like Plasma Dome. It has a life of its own now, and there are people who are really enjoying it. So it's like I had to plan to let it die when I started to do Unisonic with Costa and Dennis. I thought that I would not do any of those records anymore, but I do have the time for it. I really do. Because there's always like a year off or something where Kai is doing his gamma rays and whatever, where I can do things like that. So it's easy done for me, and I enjoy doing it. You know, it's a lot of fun to sing that stuff.
Yeah, that was actually the next thing I was going to say. What about Unisonic, which reunites you with Kai Hansen, who you've done a lot of guest work with? But I think this is actually the first time you played out with him in the former band in the years since Halloween.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first time that we're in a band together. Yeah, and that's the next thing is another record that we're wanting to do for... We're already booking festivals in Europe over here, and we're trying to make a record before the summer, you know. Let's see if that happens.
So let's talk Plasma and Dome finally. First of all, you're working with Pink Cream 69's Dennis Ward, and I understand both Timo Tolki of Stradivarius, who you worked with previously on his own solo work, and Magnus Carlson of Primal Fear were involved as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the thing is about Plasma and Dome is really the thing that I can say the least about, because it's such a patchwork production, and most of the stuff, most of the work gets done by Dennis. I mean, he has the shitty work.
Right.
You know, I only have to do the singing, and that, like, each song for me is just a challenge of its own, you know, trying to figure out how to do it and how to make it my own and how to feel comfortable with it. And when I'm done with it, I listen back to it, and whether I like it. If I don't like it, I try it again. You know, so that's all I do, really, and I do it even on my own place here.
Right.
I do the recordings here, you know, on my own.
Oh, so you don't even see the other guys.
Not even in the studio, nothing. I just enjoy myself here.
and do it. I like it that way. I even do the same thing with Una Sunny. I do the vocals myself because I want to be – I don't want to be guided by anyone else, you know. And Dennis does everything else. He gets the musicians in. He does all the band work, really.
So the only time you get to see Kai with Unisonic is when you're on tour?
In the rehearsal room.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's also cool, like the rehearsal room. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we meet here and there. But let's face it, he's also quite busy, man.
So in terms of Place Vendôme, what's the band name all about anyway? What's being referenced there?
That's a place in France. It really is. It's a round place. That's all I can tell you. I just liked it. I mean, it was one of the two suggestions Serafino had, and Place Vendôme was the second one, and I really liked it. It sounded nice.
So other than the strongly melodic, more radio-friendly focus and the loss of that omnipresent speed thrash metal guitar work of Kai Hansen that you had with Helloween, how do you feel this project really differs from what you were doing a quarter of a century ago? Because there's enough similarity there that we're not talking about an entirely new animal to my ears.
I think it's totally different in every way, in my opinion. I mean, it's just not even a band. I mean, you talk about Place Vendôme, you know. Yeah, it's not even a band. It's really a project with a lot of people involved, a lot of songwriters. That's something completely different. Like when you have a song idea, like Kai's having a song, or I have a song, or Wildcat has a song, we bring it to the rehearsal room, and then the band is fooling around with it and trying to make something out of it or whatever. You know, it's something completely different.
Because what I'm picking up is that it's still got this very 80s sound. It's very guitar-based. You got big melodic choruses, backing vocals, dramatic build.
Meant to be.
And, of course, you're soaring gongs.
It's meant to be 80s AOR. That's what it is.
See, what I'm a little bit lost on is some of the new dividing lines that came about in metal. Because to me, AOR was always the stuff they used to call corporate rock. You know, Journey, Boston, Styx, Aldo Nova, that kind of thing. All good, but, you know, they have this certain sound and dynamic. Kansas, Foreigner, the list goes on and on. These days, even when a band is very much traditional metal to my ears, somewhere between, like, you know, Rat, Doc, and early Bon Jovi, who were all very much considered metal back when, I'm finding people both inside and outside the industry making a big distinction. Like, oh, no, that's not metal. It's AOR. So, you know, to me, it seems like it's the same vibe. You know, having been back there when that was considered metal, this is like, well, you know, this is not that much different to me.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't give a damn about labeling music. You know, like, I know that people, I mean, I call it AOR because that's what Serafino had in mind, and that's how he described what he was planning to do with it, or what he would like to make a record, you know, for it. He wanted to make an AOR record. I don't think that the first and the second one really are AOR records. There are a couple of AOR songs on it. To me, AOR is something that can easily run on a radio.
Right.
Something that's catchy, and something that even someone who doesn't like metal might like. You know, that's
exactly.
To me, AOR. Exactly. But it's like on the first two records, you had tracks on there that were clearly metal songs to me. Well, some of the stuff that Dennis had written, like the longer one in the end, or the first one, I don't
right.
know, I don't remember the name.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, really metal-like.
That's kind of what I'm saying. You know, it's like the whole underground back in the 80s and the things that became black, death metal, all that kind of stuff, thrash metal, redefined the entire genre in its own image, and everything else must be pop or, you know, what they call rock.
Exactly.
So all of a sudden, you're side by side with like Eric Clapton and Bruce Springsteen, you know, flashy, accomplished guitar solos, soaring vocals, prominent distorted guitars. They don't sit well next to that kind of thing. I mean, it's melodic, but it's still metal.
It's also very subjective how people label music. I mean, if someone is into this very heavy stuff, he would probably call Helloween even something like Eagle Fly Free Pop, you know.
Exactly.
And someone who is into real pop music is probably going to call Bon Jovi heavy metal.
Right.
You know, and someone else will laugh about Bon Jovi heavy metal. Come on. You know, it's like everybody has his own kind of subjective label that he puts on. I mean, there's a general thing you can talk about, but it's like, I don't give a damn, to be honest with you, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean,
I want this really, like, a good song in the end, you know?
Right. Because, you know, if you got to cut things up like that, where do you put things like gothic and symphonic metal or power metal in that equation? Because, you know, it's like you're being punished for knowing how to resolve a proper chord change and being aware of the cycle of fists.
It was all rock and roll at the beginning, and then it became the new wave of British heavy metal. It's pretty much defined by Judas Priest, if you ask me. They kind of invented it. You know, and then that was a pretty clear definition. And then all these little kind of blood, evil, black, twisted, speed thrash, you know, you had all those genres, and then it became funny.
All this is just to say that I consider Plastic Ono Band's Thunder in the Distance to be very much a traditional heavy metal album, no matter what they're trying to classify it as these days.
Yeah, depends on the time, you know, you look at it. That's very true. I mean, some people will consider it as metal, and they're all metal fans who love it, you know.
And despite being a songwriter yourself, dating right back from your earliest days with Helloween and before, I noticed that you're still utilizing outside songwriters. Obviously, with Plastic Ono Band, you got Dennis, Tico, and Magnus, but also on Kiska Somerville with Magnus and Matt Center. I mean, it's good stuff, so I understand why, but it's not the usual thing that you get, like, you know, this is my project and I'm in control that most guys seem to stick to.
I want to save my stuff for you, Sonny, now, you know. I mean, Amanda has sent me 3 songs, actually for the next Kiska Somerville, that her future husband has written, and they wanted me wanted to see if I have some ideas for it, but I didn't get to it yet, you know, because I'm quite busy collecting material for Unisonic. I never wrote a song for Plasma at all. Dennis did on the first 2, but he didn't. I don't think he wrote anything for this last one. I think for the same reasons, because now he's in Unisonic, you know.
Right.
And Serafino, he has a lot of good songwriters on his hand, and these guys usually are so happy when they get a song recorded by musicians like Dennis and me, or like bands that have a name or whatever.
Exactly.
You know, most of those people, I mean, not so, I mean, Timo Tolki has his own band, but I don't know about the other guys, if they even have their own bands or whatever.
Right.
I mean, I just know that there are lots of songwriters out there who are just capable of writing good songs, and for them it's great if they can throw some songs in and have them recorded, you know.
Exactly.
And if it's a great song, why not? I mean, when you have a band like Unisonic, you always try to make your own material, you know. But we wouldn't die if we take a song from somewhere else either, if we need it or whatever, if we're short on time or something like that, you know.
So do you have any tour plans? Will you guys be hitting the States at any point in the coming year? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we will certainly be. I mean, that's the next thing is a record, but we're already booking festivals for Unisonic, if that's what you mean. I mean, Plasma Ono, we're never going to take on tour, but Unisonic, yeah. I know. I'm absolutely sure we're going to play Europe. Also, like, not only festivals, but also, like, normal touring. I'm absolutely sure we're going to play South America, because it was amazing last time.
Right.
It's really cool. We're definitely going to play Japan again, and we played there for almost 2 weeks.
Wow.
Some bands can't even play one show there, and we were able to play a whole bunch there. That was really nice.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's definitely the next thing to do. I mean, you got to do that. I mean, that's what you do these days, you know, you tour.
Is there anything you'd like to plug, or you want to point listeners to your website or your Facebook page?
The private site that I have doesn't make really sense to mention because it's in German. I have written like about 1,000 pages of essays, you know, about things that I
do.
Yeah, sort of like that, with about music culture and idealism and spiritualism and things that I find important and that that move me and that mean everything to me.
You
but
and Schopenhauer.
Yeah, even Schopenhauer is part of it sometimes. It's like, I mean, that's what I started with. I started with Schopenhauer, actually. That was I think it was 21 when I read everything that he had written. I didn't stick with it, you know, but that was actually my start. I loved his style. I loved his style. I thought it was really cool.
Right, the pessimist can only go so far. So,
but that's the only personal site that I have. So far, it's not in English. It's going to come out as a book, actually. There was a publishing company that actually asked me if they can release these essays as a book. And that's going to happen probably this year. And maybe one day in English. That would be great. I will suggest that to them. But other than that, there's only like the Unisonic page, which is, I don't know, Unisonic.com, I guess. You know, but it's I really don't know. I mean, I have a lot on the internet, but not so much for looking after Unisonic.
Right.
I'd rather look for Elvis records or something like that.
Well, with that, Michael, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema. And, you know, I'd love to have you back on to talk to your next album or project.
Yeah, it was a good interview. Good questions.
All right. So thank you again. And like I said, it was a pleasure. And the next project you have, I'd love to have you back.
I'm sure it's going to be maybe Kiska Somerville. Pretty sure that's the next thing. I don't think that we're going to be that fast with Unisonic, but you never know.
Well, sounds good. And again, it was a pleasure.
Thanks, man. Thanks for your interest.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And to close out our interview with Michael, here's another one off Thunder in the Distance, which is thankfully not a cover of that lame Mr. Mister song. This is Broken Wings.
changed and time's moving on. Cause nothing stays the same.
Next week on Third Eye Cinema, Alex Staropoli of Dungeons & Dragons-inspired symphonic power metal legends Rhapsody of Fire. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician and like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back. If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And next week...
Hi, this is Alex Taropoli from Rhapsody of Fire, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy!